everyone. Well, welcome to Stutter Talk episode 550. Can you believe it? For September 10th to 2015. I'm Peter Reitz, starting off with some good voluntary stuttering. I'd like to welcome back great Stutter Talk friend and advisor, Dr. Nan Bernstein Ratner. Hey, Nan.
Hey, good to talk to you again.
I can't believe it's taken us 550 episodes to get to the big question today, which is, what is stuttering? You'd think we would have done that 7 or 8 years ago.
Well, some of the big questions, you know, like, what is the meaning of life? They take the longest to answer.
Yeah. And you are absolutely the perfect person to do this show with, and I think we agree we're going to really try to stick to early preschool stuttering and not talk about late onsets and adult onsets, correct?
Yeah, I think in particular, because you and I have expressed concerns over people using terminology with young children that seems imprecise or inaccurate, I think it's best to start with that age group and spend our time there.
That's great. So I'm going to read a bio for you and do a little intro, and then most of the show is going to be hearing your expertise on this topic. Dr. Nan Bernstein Ratner is professor in the Department of Hearing and Speech Sciences at the University of Maryland, College Park. Nan is a fellow and honors recipient of the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association. Sometimes we just call that ASHA. And Dr. Ratner is author of numerous articles and chapters addressing language acquisition and fluency, and is co-author with Oliver Bloodstein of a handbook on stuttering, the sixth edition. In its sixth edition, one of the most respected and cited stuttering texts of our time. And of course, you are an advisor to Stutter Talk, and I'm sorry we bother you so much, Nan.
Oh, no, it's always fun talking to you.
You give a lot of behind-the-scenes advice and recommendations, and it's much appreciated.
Well, thank you.
So, okay, here's my intro, Nan. Over the past 15 years as an SLP, as a speech language pathologist, I've heard many conversations about something that people call normal stuttering. And you hear all the time of, oh, that child's going through a period of normal stuttering. And recently I heard a speech language pathologist explain that if the child is stuttering for about a year, then they explain the stuttering, this is no longer normal stuttering, as if to suggest stuttering between, you know, one day and a year is somehow typical or normal, but after about a year, it's no longer normal. Do you hear things like this? Do you see things like this?
Yeah, I do. The other term that I hear thrown into the mix is normal developmental disfluency. And it is kind of interesting because I think it's not very good use of terminology, frankly. When children stutter, they do things that are very, very different and by definition not typical of early development. And we do have research at this point that quite clearly states that children do not, for instance, move into stuttering from something that looks quite normal. From the moment that stuttering first emerges with the characteristics that you and I think we'll get into in a minute, it's not at all like typical developmental disfluency. Normal developmental disfluency, or what I think these people are referring to when they say normal stuttering, has to do more with behaviors than how long it lasts. And it's basically the notion that it's when children hesitate or repeat or revise in their speech. I don't think that any professionals would seriously argue that it is normal for children to block or have vocal breaks during speaking, or in fact have fears about speaking or negative emotional or cognitive reactions to speaking. None of that is part of typical development. What I think people are confusing here, and I think it's very interesting because it's actually happened in the late talker literature as well, is whether or not, if you have a disorder that a lot of kids actually grow out of, whether or not it's a disorder at all. And the issue here is that we know that 80% of kids who start to stutter will grow out of that behavior. But that doesn't mean they weren't stuttering. They were stuttering and they grew out of it. It's like if you got the flu and you recover, it doesn't mean you didn't have the flu. And we do a great disservice to our understanding of a disorder if we don't define a disorder by its symptoms, but rather wait and see how it turns out to look back and define it. In medicine, they won't do that. In our field, we shouldn't do that. Just because things work out for the best and a child recovers doesn't mean that we don't carefully assess how the child looks at presentation and talk about the disorder as it is. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to monitor its progress and intervene properly when we decide that we need to intervene.
I don't know if it's your sense, but my sense is one of the reasons that people talk about developmental disfluency or normal stuttering is that it so often does stop by itself. So there's kind of this experience of, well, if we just wait a year and call it normal, then the chances are it's going to go away.
Well, I understand that. But, you know, when I talk to parents, very often parents come to the university to talk to either me or Vivian Siskin, because, you know, we're at the same site, and they're looking for confirmation. Does my child really stutter? And of course, many of them are hoping that perhaps we'll say that the child doesn't stutter. And I often start by saying, I have good news and bad news. You know, the good news is you're absolutely correct. Your child does stutter, and you may think that that is, in fact, bad news. But here's the good news. 80% of children who start to stutter stop. So we don't have to not call it stuttering to make you happy. What you need to know is that in 80% of cases, stuttering that is real stuttering, and that we have the research literature on this, goes away by itself, and it all makes some of us our therapists that work with that population either seem very frustrated or very happy, because, you know, if you can do virtually anything or nothing and children get better, that's quite powerful. And in fact, it's one of the things that you and I have talked about, that bedevils efforts to figure out whether or not early intervention programs work, because the number of kids you need to treat when 80% of them will get better anyhow is just enormous, and it's a real problem space for us. But I think that they're trying to be nice to parents by sort of saying, well, I don't know if I want to call it stuttering yet until we wait around. And I don't think that that does anybody any good. Again, often parents come in and they think they have noticed something that's aberrant. I have yet recently, ever since the dawn of the internet age, when parents can bring down clips from the Stuttering Foundation or other groups to look at stuttering samples, I have really not had more than one or two parents in 20 years come in and think that their child had a problem with their fluency that I was not, in fact, in agreement with. And so the parents come in thinking something is obviously wrong, and they're usually guided by a bunch of symptoms that don't seem normal to them, and they are correct. And I don't think that we do anybody a service by saying, well, because I think it will go away, I don't want to call it stuttering, or I want to call it normal stuttering to make them feel better, because in a disorder that's going to get better very often by itself, we're not doing the parent any good or harm necessarily by just misnaming it, but we're doing a tremendous amount of damage to being accurate in terms of what the parents understand and in documenting where the child started and where they wind up.
So, Nana, I couldn't agree with you more. And I'll tell you that in 15 years, I used to be able to say I've never met a parent who wrongly diagnosed their child as stuttering. But about 2 years ago, I did. So in 15 years, I've worked with one family who told me their child stuttered and the child did not. And I worked in the school with this child, so I could see the child all the time. And they really did not stutter. However, I have seen time and time again speech language pathologists diagnose stuttering, and it's not. And it's not. And I was sitting on a preschool team a few years ago, and the paperwork in front of me diagnosed the child as stuttering. And it said in the paperwork that the mother disagreed. And I remember saying to the therapist, well, why did you diagnose stuttering? They're like, well, we did the SSI-4 and we counted stutters and it came up stuttering.
Okay. Yeah, I think no assessment is 100% accurate. In my experience, the SSI-4 is pretty good. But I think there is this huge problem in determining what you count. And there isn't a whole lot of good guidance on that with the SSI. And in fact, there's not a whole lot of guidance as to whether or not when you're counting words, do you count the intended words? Do you count all the words? How do you treat multiple part iterations. I mean, there's a lot of ways to score that thing wrong, and not as the Rileys intended it to be scored.
Yeah.
The other thing that the Rileys would clearly have agreed on is that you don't take behaviors that are fairly unconscious, not very egregious in terms of how long or stressful they are, and sort of override your personal opinion about the whole picture, the gestalt of what you see in front of you, simply because of a number. I think if we ran the SSI 3 on children with language problems, if we ran the SSI 4, shows how old I am, if we ran the SSI 4 on children who are English language learners, many children with limited capacity, you'd find that they would easily score in a pathological area. You know, they would score as people who have moderate, perhaps stuttering, mild to moderate stuttering or worse. But the issue is that listening to their behaviors, we understand that they don't resemble classic stuttering and that they're probably not, they're not caused by the things that we imagine might cause stuttering.
And that's exactly what happened here. So the child spoke Spanish and English, Spanish probably better. The mother was speaking through an interpreter. And I'm, you know, that's, I'm pretty sure that is exactly what took place. This is Stutter Talk. Peter Wrights is here with Dr. Nan Bernstein-Ratner, and we're getting at the topic of what is stuttering. So I want to read something to you and to the listener. So right before we went on air, I went to the ASHA.org website. That's the American Speech Language Hearing Association. We're both members. You have the honors of the association. I don't. You do. So that's very awesome. And I went to the ASHA site because my assumption was it was going to be a very good definition of stuttering, and I could kind of brag about it and present that to you and have you explain it to us. But I was kind of amazed by how much I don't like this definition. So I'm just going to read you the very first paragraph, what is stuttering, at ASHA.org, and we'll put the link up at stuttertalk.com episode 550. So, quote, stuttering affects the fluency of speech. It begins during childhood and in some cases lasts throughout life. The disorder is characterized by disruptions in the production of speech sounds, also called disfluencies. Most people produce brief disfluencies from time to time. For instance, some words are repeated and others are preceded by or a. Disfluencies are not necessarily a problem. However, they can impede communication when a person produces too many of them. Now, again, it's just one paragraph from a very long web page here, but isn't that kind of like saying everybody kind of stutters? I mean, take it where you will, Nan.
Well, I think it presumes it almost, I went to the site after you called my attention to it. It's ironic, of course, that many of us that are in the field don't go and look at things like that every day. But it's almost as though a lot of what we understand as experts is presumed here. And I think that what we know at this point, and I don't know at what point this description was written, is that we found it more useful recently to refer to certain things as stutter-like disfluencies and to distinguish them from typical disfluencies. Ehud Yeri was one of the first people, I believe, to use that phrase, and a lot of us like it. And it seems to have the word stuttering and disfluency in each sentence, and it makes it seem as though they're synonyms for one another. And in fact, they're not. Stutters are very particular types of disfluencies. We might say that disfluency is sort of the large category or the umbrella term. But in fact, many of the things that define stuttering don't overlap with typical disfluency at all. And even when they overlap in sort of very broad, shallow ways, like a part word repetition or a sound repetition, which you can find in the speech of people talking, and I think I just did one, basically, you don't find them characterized by the same degree of tension. You don't find them characterized by the same number of iterations or repetitions. So it's very, very cumbersome language that throws two terms around from sentence to sentence that I think encourages perhaps our own therapists to be confused about where the dividing line is between calling something just a disfluency and calling something stuttering or a stutter-like disfluency, which is a much more specific term. And just as we were talking about, clearly any child who comes in who's repeating things or hesitating or doing even stuttering things like blocking, they're all disfluent. But there is such a thing as normal disfluency. But it would never be characterized by the behaviors that concern us when a child is stuttering. And again, you and I are in agreement, you know, I've had one or two people come in over the course of time, and I started working here in the very early 1980s when I was actually just in kindergarten. but the issue is that when parents come in, they're not concerned by these things that we would consider the disfluencies that we see in everybody's speech. They are very alarmed. They're alarmed by things that reflect awareness, tension, struggle, multiple iterations. I've had children come in and repeat something 10 times. And they're very concerned sometimes by very non-speech behaviors, such as starting to avoid words, often within a few days after starting to stutter. And those things would not be considered stuttering, would not be considered normal. So I think there are a couple of issues here. One is that when somebody calls something normal disfluency, after scoring it and actually appreciating that it is stuttering, and then they simply rename it as something typical because they think somebody will outgrow it, that's an error in one direction. It's really not allowing us, in some sense, if that SLT were part of a study or part of a community tracking assignment, to call stuttering something normal at that point, simply because you thought it would go away, would feed into very inaccurate views of how often stuttering fixes itself. So I'm sure you're aware of the fact that a couple of years back, Riley and her coworkers in Australia actually said that perhaps the incidence of early childhood stuttering is even higher than we think, and therefore the proportion that get better on their own is even higher than we think. It could be in the high 80s, for instance, high 80%. Rather than just 80%, because if you go into the community, you may find that more kids are actually stuttering than you think. And so a clinician who wants to call stuttering something else, wants to call it normal because she or he hopes it will just go away on its own, would lead to us not understanding very well how often little children do go through a phase where they are clearly stuttering as we define it. In other words, just like you can have diabetes or not have diabetes, I think that we understand at some point how to diagnose stuttering. And we have a set of criteria. It's not just the frequency of non-fluent segments, but we have a lot of different multifaceted criteria on tests like the SSI-4, on tests like the test of childhood stuttering. And we know what we're looking at. And so if somebody misdiagnoses or terms it something it's not, that is an error. Okay. Likewise, of course, if somebody is really stuttering, if somebody is not really stuttering but is labeled as somebody who is stuttering, in the case of your example, a child with limited English proficiency, then what we're going to get is a child who appears to qualify for a service like stuttering therapy that in no sense will help their problem. Since in a case of the child you're talking about, one would presume that if they knew language better, if they knew English better, their speech would be more fluent. Well, that's not a function of stuttering therapy.
Mm. Yes, I completely agree. And you mentioned the importance of stuttering like disfluencies. And I just love that term, those seminal articles from the late 90s by Yairi and Ambrose and their colleagues. And could you talk a little bit about what is stuttering from that research and from the term stuttering like disfluencies? Because they listed a few types of disfluencies that non-stutterers might do, but they're really associated with young children who stutter, and of course adults too.
Right. There is this one category that still gets sort of bantered around a little bit, and that's the category of a whole word repetition, as when a child says something like, mommy, mommy, mommy. That one, various people are not sure how to characterize. The Illinois Stuttering Project data seem to suggest that they are much more prevalent in the speech of children who are stuttering because they coexist with some other behaviors. Things that are not stuttering, I'll start with that, would be phrase repetition and phrase revision, and hesitations, just stopping and pausing in the stream of speech. There are obviously a few behaviors that children demonstrate that could be seen in typically developing kids and are simply seen more often in kids who stutter. A good example of that would be part word repetitions or single syllable word repetitions. And the only way to really distinguish them in the speech of a child who stutters from that of a child who's typically developing would be the number of times that word is repeated. So a typically developing child might repeat a word twice, mommy, mommy, or a syllable twice, like ma, mommy, whereas we've seen children repeat things 8-10 times, which we do not feel is at all typical, and we would call that a stuttering-like disfluency. The weighting scale that Yeri and his team developed actually says what you need to do is you really need to multiply the number of times you see those behaviors by the average number of repetitions or iterations that you see inside those behaviors in order to weight them properly, so that you don't treat all part word repetitions in a child's speech and all single syllable word repetitions as the same thing, because qualitatively we would agree that a child who repeats something once and a child who repeats something 8 times are not the same kind of child. And then there are these other behaviors that we just don't see very often in typically developing children, if ever, and that would be blocking, which is the defining characteristic of stuttering. If you ask most people, most typical speakers never are speechless and trying to get words out and not finding the ability to do so. The second behavior that's sort of in that category would be a prolongation of a speech sound, like a consonant, so holding on to an S or holding on to an L or something like that. Excuse me. And so for that reason, when the Illinois Project got going, it decided in its weighting formula that when you see blocks or prolongations, you don't just count them and add them to the formula. You multiply them by twice the number of times you see them. In other words, you weight them 2 times as strongly, because they are not at all typical behaviors. And so you want to up the score for a child who you see doing blocking and prolonging of sounds. If you do all this, I think it's the single best example of data that show that normal childhood disfluency or developmental disfluency is not the same thing as stuttering. So in the Illinois Project, which to date has been the most careful longitudinal assessment of children close to the onset of stuttering, following them over time, when you use a formula like this, children who are, quote, normally developmentally disfluent do show some behaviors. No child is perfectly fluent. Little kids are disfluent when they learn to talk. But their average score, if you run through a language sample, is something under 2 if you use this kind of formula. Whereas in the Illinois Project, when parents brought kids in and thought that they stuttered and the team agreed, their average score was over 20. There's not even any close parallel between these kinds of scores, indicating that the population of children who are stuttering is not somehow really able to be confused with the population of children who are just having a little bit of temporary difficulty learning to talk.
Let me say a few things to you and the listeners just to get your feedback. So One thing is that you were mentioning that so the normal disfluencies are often the hesitations or the phrase repetitions. And I just want to remind people that we're talking about very young children, three, 4, 5 years old. So if you're an adult who stutters, who's listening, you might have halting speech at times that might be closely related to blocking or something, but you might have that halting dysrhythmic speech. But we're not talking about these type of speech patterns that are reactive to a lifetime of stuttering. Does that make sense? I'm just trying to clarify that.
Well, it's hard to say that because I've seen some preschoolers who are stuttering. That's my opinion. And they both by behavior and also by their orientation towards their speech. So if I've seen a child who has already started to swap out words and the parent can tell that the child has started to change the words that they will use, then that would be another piece of evidence that the child is not typical. Is that what you're asking, Peter? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think I'm making a whole blunder of it. I'm going to say this to you off air. I just know that we have a lot of adults who stutter who listen. And so when they hear, or maybe I'll keep this on air. I don't, this is probably good stuff. But when folks hear that a hesitation is more of a normal disfluency than a stutter, you know, we're really talking specifically about preschoolers. So yes, us adults, including myself, might hesitate. That might almost be a reaction to a lifetime of stuttering. In fact, Nan, I'll tell you, there was an excellent article by Emma Alpern that I read yesterday that just came out. And she mentioned about how, I don't know if she used the word halting speech, but she mentioned that her speech sometimes doesn't have a natural flow. Like, I'm being careful.
Sure.
Here. Yeah.
Sure. And I wish you'd send me that link. I'd like to see it.
Sure.
I think, yes, if you decide to keep this segment in.
I'm going
to
keep it in. I'm keeping it in. Yeah. Yeah.
I love these conversations we have.
Yeah.
Basically, you're correct that adults might hesitate to consider their options, what words they might want to use, whether or not they even want to say anything. And so in adult speech, a hesitation could have very different functions. Here we're talking about little kids who basically, when they start to talk, there's no real evidence they're pre-planning all that much. And so what we would typically see in a little child would be the difference between a break in the continuity of speech that might be due to something like blocking or just a small silence as the child is trying to figure out what to say next. And those would be very different behaviors, and a careful clinician should be able to tell the difference.
Those are excellent points. And I want to bring up something else. And yeah, I probably shouldn't say these things, but it's what I'm thinking, so I'm going to give you my honest thoughts here. There are times where I'm working in the schools where we're working with children, we're trying to help them, and we think, you know, they might be on the spectrum. So we send them for an evaluation as part of a whole process. We do interventions. We try to meet their needs. And frankly, we might not know. And part of the team might think, yes, the child's autistic, and part of the team might think, no way. However, with stuttering, I don't think there's been a single time in my life where I've needed to look at a score that I've computated on a piece of paper to know if a child is truly stuttering. I can't think of a single make or break moment. In fact, it seems like I know often pretty quickly if the child is stuttering or not. And so all these part word repetitions we're talking about, the big red flag of blocking and prolongations, kind of like we know what stuttering is. Do you take it where you will?
Yeah, I think that certainly if children block in front of me even once, or if I hear pitch breaks and vocal breaks in the middle of words, or they look like they're discomforted by their speech, or the parent reports that they're swapping out their words. And I had a child referred to me years ago who had only just turned two, which would be a very young onset for stuttering. And I tried to reassure the mother to wait a little bit, that 80% of kids grew out very quickly. And maybe even if the child was stuttering, we didn't need to see him yet. And she said, well, no, I can't wait because he's already started to avoid using words. And she gave the example of a two-year-old who had had a moment only earlier that week, a few days after starting to stutter, where he stuttered on the word blankie, which was his favorite little drag-along item. And within a day, he had started referring to it by a new name. He called it by its color, and he would say that he wanted his green rather than his blankie. You know, those are kids that I don't have any problem diagnosing right off the bat. And certainly when you see the speech behaviors of multiple iterations or awareness or struggle or blocking or prolongations of consonants. And I think what's frustrating to both you and me, which is what got this conversation going, is that we will actually sort of see people doing the very tedious math on an SSI or some other assessment to document the fact that the child seems to be stuttering, and they will even come up with a concomitant behavior score and then do something, as you started out the discussion by saying, but it's normal because I think the child will outgrow it. And, you know, basically things that are normal are things that are normal, and things that are outgrown are things that are outgrown, but they are not one and the same thing. I think that all of us would agree that headaches are not fun. We all, quote, outgrow them unless we have a brain tumor. But it doesn't mean that it's not a condition that we want to treat. And I think that we do a tremendous disservice to ourselves as a profession if we can't learn to use our terminology more accurately here. And I think the irony of what you and I are talking about, because we've come up with both of these sort of diametrically opposed kinds of examples, is that we have people seeing stuttering and diagnosing it as normal because they think it'll be outgrown. And then we have people diagnosing children as stuttering who are really having very different problems. They are having trouble encoding language because they have delayed language. I've written a bit about that. Or because they are limited English users, and other people have talked quite a bit about that. The most recent person to really make an excellent case that many children who are bilingual are misdiagnosed as stuttering is Courtney Bird down at the University of Texas at Austin. And that's as much concern to me as anything else, because you really don't want to enroll children in therapy for stuttering whose disfluencies are not stutter-like and who don't, in fact, stutter, because the last time I looked, and I'm sure you would agree as a fellow professional, the kind of things you do for stuttering therapy and the kinds of things you do to teach English are two very different things.
Yeah, and that, of course, opens up a whole nother can of worms, because I'm the only public school speech language pathologist I know who does preschool stuttering with a parent. So,
Here at Maryland, we would agree with you. You are not alone.
Yeah. Actually, no, I know one other, but not. So I know Nina Reeves, and I know she works in the schools, and I know she works with parents, but I know great people who do this job. I don't personally have colleagues that I know who invite parents in for sessions with preschoolers, certainly not on a regular basis.
Well, it's funny because the system really doesn't encourage it. It may be a bit tangential, but it's definitely a spot. It's definitely a position that I feel strongly about too. I mean, it's hard for parents often to get in and deal with the school-based therapist. And there is also this misunderstanding in many cases, and I think it's all through our profession, that it's sort of like handing your child over for piano lessons to send them into the speech language pathologist, that clearly everything that needs to be fixed up will be fixed up when they are sitting when you are sitting across from their child, and that outside intervention is unnecessary and doesn't do anything. And we all know that whenever you involve parents, you get a much better outcome. But sometimes the parents themselves aren't aware of that.
Yeah, I'm working on that. I've actually spoken to my district, which includes our preschool assessment team, and encouraging them from the very first meetings with parents that if the child is stuttering at the very beginning, prepare them that the therapist will be calling you to set up appointments, because stuttering isn't like everything else. Now, as you said, there's other things obviously that parent involvement helps with, but as far as speech language pathology, it's normal not to invite the parent in for preschool stuttering treatment when it should be normal to invite them in. And as long as we're talking about pitfalls, another thing that drives me crazy is that you do the whole evaluation, the speech language pathologist finds the child is stuttering, and then they say, but the academic criteria to receive services is that the stuttering has to affect you in school, and we don't see any evidence of that.
Well, I do think that once the child is firmly in the academic setting, and districts differ as to how much before kindergarten they're really going to take charge of the kid's life. Once the kid is in a real academic setting, and even in the preschool years there in the public schools, most kids have some typical expectations during the day, things like sharing time, circle time, and that does impact, I think we can demonstrate, usually for many kids, that their ability to be fluent may impact their ability either to engage in those behaviors, which are part of the curriculum, or to be paid attention to during those particular interactions, which becomes a social consequence. Certainly, if those children are not socializing with other kids well, or children are not socializing with them, I think that, our laws at this point are pretty clear that the academic setting is not confined to the stuff that's on your report card.
Yeah.
It extends to the social context of school, school activities, anything that happens in the course of the school day, and extracurricular activities, which, of course, I don't think too many preschoolers are involved in. But the issue is that it shouldn't be too hard to document a consequence of the stuttering and somehow manage to fit it in to the state standards. Even around here in kindergarten, you're supposed to know something about your general health and body, and the notion that you have a disorder that's impacting your ability to communicate adequately. If you go looking at many of, I know that people are really not happy in some places with the Common Core, but if you look at the state standards, in many places at every level, from kindergarten on up, you can find something that stuttering will impact if you look closely.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. This is Stutter Talk, Peter Reitzes with Dr. Nan Bernstein Ratner, professor in the Department of Hearing and Speech Sciences at the University of Maryland College Park, and so much more. Nan, can I ask you a few more questions?
Sure.
So just a general statement that I'd love to get, if you can confirm it or just take a minute on it, is we were talking before the show about these things, and you had joked, if I understood you correctly, that, you know, well, this diagnosing stuttering is kind of like porn. You know it when you see it. And I completely agree with you. And so I'm going to say to you that if you take a little time to learn about stuttering, I don't think it's that hard to diagnose stuttering in preschoolers who stutter. Do you agree?
I think it's not hard to diagnose. I think what happens is that people are diagnosing and then they're searching for the right terminology. And that's what's getting us frustrated here in this interaction when we're talking about imprecise use of language. I mean, when somebody fills out an SSI-4 and gives me a score that is in the moderate range for a child, I think in conjunction with other things that are usually in the report about parental concern and what they noticed, that they've diagnosed stuttering, but then they've chosen to label it in a funny way based on this confusion about whether or not they think the child will outgrow it. And they're basically confusing the notion of recovery from stuttering with whether or not it's appropriate to label it as stuttering, even if it will go away. And again, the medical community doesn't hesitate to label a disorder. It doesn't hesitate to label something as eczema or asthma or whatever condition that, or food allergy, and children may outgrow them. It doesn't mean they didn't have them at the time that they were assessed. And so I think we need to get out of the imprecision inherent in trying to take a crystal ball and figure out where the child will be in a year or two, as opposed to where they are right now. Where they are right now should determine the diagnosis. Either you're looking at stuttering or you're not looking at stuttering. And I think most clinicians are pretty good, with the few exceptions we have used in this particular interview, where people confuse limited English proficiency, for instance, for stuttering, and that shouldn't be happening. But occasionally it does. I think the thing that motivated our interaction today was the notion that many, many speech-language pathologists who do understand what stuttering is have chosen sometimes to phrase it in odd ways on reports. And I'm not sure that that's a very accurate thing to do.
Yeah, and after we had planned this show, because we had talked about it weeks ago, I just saw a report. And it's for a child who's 6 years old, and they just started stuttering. And the speech language pathologist suggests to, quote, add stuttering to the IEP as it is no longer a normal period of disfluent speech due to his age. And like, I hear things like this all the time. So it kind of suggests, well, the child's almost 7, so it has to be stuttering. But a year ago, we wouldn't have called this stuttering.
Right. Yeah. I think that's just doing our profession a tremendous disservice. It's doing that kid and the family a disservice. A year earlier, if the reports are there, if that similar behavior was there, it was stuttering. And there's a difference between deciding that you want to wait and see if it's going to recover on its own for various reasons, and then deciding you want to intervene because it's quite clear that it's not going to recover on its own, but it's been stuttering all along.
Yes, agreed. And sort of to piggyback on something you just said about how we talk about these issues, I've been seeing forever the term fluency used instead of stuttering. So I see reports in IEPs all the time which states the child has a fluency problem. We're going to work on fluency goals. you know, the term stuttering is never used. It's like we're cleansing our universe of this bad.
And it's like, become like the S word, huh?
Yeah, it's like, yeah. What's going on?
I don't know. I don't actually know. I mean, to say that somebody has a fluency problem is no better or worse than saying something like they have a language problem or they have a speech problem. It's just way imprecise a term to use. And it's not inaccurate, but I would, if somebody said this child has a fluency problem, I'd be immediately saying of what sort? Because a child could have a fluency problem if they had an expressive language disorder. They could have a fluency problem if they had English as a second language. I want to know what they're talking about. So I don't know that we do ourselves any favors, again, in terms of understanding the child in front of us or understanding what to do for the child in front of us if we keep using the term disfluency or fluency to talk about something that is we already have decided or know is stuttering.
It's so absurd. It's kind of like, and you know, I used to teach graduate courses, and some of them in the bulletins were titled fluency, not stuttering, not even fluency disorders, just fluency.
Well, yeah, Viv and I teach a class here that is called fluency disorders. We do, however, I will point out, teach other fluency disorders in the class. So I do an entire lecture when I do it on how to distinguish stuttering from cluttering, from second language proficiency, from other kinds of disorders. So I don't know that the course labels are necessarily where the problem is, because many courses will also study cluttering and hopefully how to distinguish something that looks like stuttering from something that's not. But I it's a problem. I don't really know where we got at this situation. I do sometimes wonder, and this is my speculation to you, but you're the kind of show where I can do this, that in a sense, what I see running through many people's minds when they look at stuttering in very young children is a reluctance to call it stuttering for reasons that they can't even articulate, but I think really very much go back to the diagnosogenic theory of stuttering.
Oh, agreed, 100%.
And so there is this, I know the fear is in the parents, and the parents will come in and they're tiptoeing around with the child. You know, what do you do when the child stutters? Nothing. You know, what do you call it? Nothing. Please, can my child not be here when you talk about why he's here? I've even allowed children to be brought in with parents sort of saying that they're bringing their child in to train the teachers here in the clinic, you know, that they need children to train themselves on. Because some parents are very, very afraid to label stuttering. I think as a profession, the SLPs, some of them are not far behind. And I think they're hard-pressed to identify the source of the problem, but I think it is that they believe that if they talk about it, it's going to stick. Now, one of the things we know is that stuttering does not derive from normal disfluency. It is not a continuous function. There is normal disfluency in children, and there is stuttering, and they are absolutely separate pathways. One does not go into the other. The other thing that we know, surprisingly enough, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, but we know very clearly, I think, from the Lidcombe program, is that just because you pay attention to stuttering and bring it out there in the open for work doesn't mean it's going to stick. Okay? We're all basically fighting over whether or not Lidcombe is better than any other form of intervention, or whether or not it's better, arguably, than spontaneous recovery, because of that problem with the numbers that I'm talking about often. But If the diagnosogenic theory were right, the Lidcombe program should create chaos. It should create many more children who don't get better. And we know that that's not true. And so I think that when people use the term disfluency to avoid the term stuttering, to somehow, I don't know what they're thinking, to spare the parent, to spare themselves, I don't know the motivation. It's not necessary, and it's harmful. We need to, as a profession, be able to diagnose something correctly. If I were to sort of say, if somebody had asthma, well, he sometimes has trouble breathing, that doesn't really tell me whether he's just run a mile or he has trouble breathing sitting in a room.
Yeah.
And I don't want to confuse those two things. I wouldn't know what kind of treatment to give or whether or not to consider it a target for intervention. If we continue to call things normal that are not, we're going to start making some very typical, very bad mistakes in terms of how we treat children and how we understand the life course of the disorder from our records.
I going to say it again. I agree with everything you just said. It used to make me want to throw up. My incredible, great colleagues in Brooklyn, I can't tell you how many times I was asked when I worked in Brooklyn, is it okay to talk about stuttering? Will it make the problem worse? And, you know, and it never worked. So one of the ways I could respond is, well, is there any evidence to support that? And like, I stopped using that argument because that argument never persuade anybody.
Yeah, there's always that lingering doubt. Well, I don't know, and so I'll err on the side of caution. What harm will it do to call it disfluency rather than stuttering? But, you know, you and I have spent the last, you know, half hour saying that it really does do a disservice at some point. It really does.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm going to, if you permit me a joke here, like imagine if we were signing up for a class on cerebral palsy, but instead of the syllabus saying cerebral palsy, the class was titled normal muscle movements. I mean, it's that absurd. It's like talking, and like, so I'm okay with a class being called fluency disorders. I'm not okay with a class being called fluency.
I think that might be quite correct, actually. Yeah.
So let me ask you just one last question, and maybe a second will pop up. But I get asked about secondary behaviors in preschoolers who stutter, 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds all the time. And there's a general assumption that, oh, no, the child's 2.5 or 3. I just saw a secondary. This means something. This is terrible. This is a big deal. And I find myself calmly saying to our colleagues, actually, it's very common for a 3-year-old to have secondary behaviors, which is one of the reasons I don't really like the term very much. What do you make of that conversation?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. We do have a presumption that little children are not as aware, and I would say that little children are a mixed bag in that respect. I've seen children who seem to show much more awareness than others. Almost always, if a child's doing a lot of atypical behaviors, such as a block, which, as we've been talking about, is a cardinal symptom, there is some degree of stress and tension behind a block inherently. That's what distinguishes it from just pausing to think. And I do think that little children do have secondary behaviors. One of the things that was most interesting to me about the Illinois Project data when push came to shove and everything had been collected is that although most of us are now fairly familiar with some of the things that predict chronicity and recovery in kids, such as boys recovering less often, later onsets recovering less often than earlier onsets, poorer language recovering less often than good language. One of the things that was most fascinating to me was stuff that doesn't usually make the list, which is of all the things that didn't predict recovery, severity as defined by a total sum score of things like whether or not you had very long moments of stuttering and you had secondary behaviors, that did not predict anything. So, you know, as a result, I don't think that we need to be alarmed. I guess your example, sort of the reason why I immediately thought of those data, was that if therapists are afraid that if a child shows secondaries, it means that they are not a good candidate for recovery, and they start counseling the parents to be a little bit more despondent about the chances that the child will recover, that's not a well-founded approach to the problem, because in fact severity of stuttering at its onset doesn't appear to really predict whether or not the child will get better or not. But it, to my mind, that's one of the most fascinating pieces of information that came out of that study, and it's one of the most surprising.
Sticking with severity, so assuming for conversational sake that secondaries are distinctly different from primary stuttering behaviors, the part where repetitions, the prolongations, the blocks, what Yairi and Ambrose called the dysrhythmic phonations. So in my own personal experience as a therapist with preschoolers who stutter, I don't see evidence that children who exhibit secondary behaviors at a very young age are more likely to continue to stutter than children who might not when you first start seeing them. Does your experience or the research say much about that?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was alluding to with the Illinois Project, that in the general scheme of things, when they tried to factor in many, many things that might predict children who continue to stutter as opposed to children who recovered, the presence or absence of secondaries or the severity of stuttering in terms of the frequency of stuttered events, that really was not predictive. Obviously, I think that work needs to be replicated, but I think that you and I as clinicians could probably say that that might be correct. In my own experiment that I did a number of years ago and wrote a number of articles on, where we tracked about 15 kids from very shortly after onset, we got them within 3 months after they started to stutter, often within a month. Some of the kids that we saw early on who were not particularly noticeable in terms of the frequency or severity of their stuttering, one of them is still stuttering. We know that because that person has appeared in some stuttering publications, and so I've been able to track that person. And some of the kids who looked really involved got better, and they got better rather quickly. So it's really hard to make those predictions. Maybe the way to end all of this is to basically go back to the question of, can we predict who's going to get better and who's not in stuttering? And the answer is always, even for things where we think we have good information, the answer is always that we have population statistics. You know, my father was an insurance agent, a life insurance agent.
Okay.
And he liked to point out to young people when he was trying to sell, say, a young father like yourself, a life insurance policy. And often young fathers would say, but, you know, I'm not likely to die tomorrow. And that's true. But the risk to your family, if you did die tomorrow, is absolute, right? So a population statistic tells you that a person of a certain age is not likely to die, but it doesn't guarantee the safety of the individual. And all we have in stuttering right now is we have, because that's the way research operates, unless we can find a marker of absolute prediction, which we don't have, that yes, if you're a boy, you're less likely to outgrow. If you start later, you're less likely to outgrow. If you have a family history of persistent stuttering, you're less likely to outgrow. But all of those things are population statistics, and they are not anywhere close to being predictive, either in combination or one by one. And that's really why we need more research in that particular area, because it would be nice if we could more accurately say, when we see a child, not only are you stuttering, but I have a fairly good sense that you're going to get better, and so you can make parents really feel a lot better and give them some counseling. Or I see this child stuttering, and I have this unfortunate sense from this marker that I've picked up, whatever it is, that if we don't go in there early and start working, that it's not going to go away by itself. And we're not anywhere close to that. We're only close to sort of being on a teeter-totter, where there's sort of, or a set of scales, where there are these predictors that sort of predict less good outcomes and predictors that predict better outcomes, but none of them are determinations. And that's what we really, really need. Unfortunately, I don't think we're any more likely to come up with them than we are to have had some predictor that my father could have used to tell somebody their absolute risk. You know, so yeah. I think that that's the problem in any field, is that unless we can find really, really, really firm markers, if you have, you know, some markers for breast cancer at this point, yeah, the odds are very, very, very high and you should do something. But in our field, we just don't have those kinds of markers for kids and communication disorders, particularly in stuttering.
Yeah, and you permit me, I have to throw a little tiny wrench into this, which is sort of inspired or been thinking about what you said about following one of your subjects long term because he turned up in another paper or study. You know, my suspicion about myself, and it's hard to really think back about what happened to me, you know, but I do have some paperwork from when I was a kid that detail stuttering through maybe I was 10 years old. And then everybody just thought I stopped stuttering. And I know that I went very, very covert. And a part of me thinks I chose being covert over the eye clenching and all the secondary stuff and all that stuff I didn't want to do. And so while I might have appeared to have recovered, in some ways the problem got a lot worse. You just really couldn't see it.
Yeah, and that's the topic of so many of your great interviews, is that stuttering is a moving target. It evolves over the course of a lifetime. I like to say that it really challenges us on all levels. the client in front of you today, who's a stuttering adult, does not look like the client might have looked at the age of 3 or 4. And everybody's shaped not only by having the disorder across the lifespan, but their life experiences. And it also really does speak to the point that even for somebody like me who spends part of my time in the lab in basic science, knowing what causes stuttering may not at all be the right answer to treating it, because stuttering will have changed from the things that started it in the first place and the things that are happening now. My own orientation is to do research into the possible language encoding factors in stuttering. And while I feel that they might be very, very influential in why a child starts to stutter at the age of 2.5, I'm going to be the last person to suggest that a 50-year-old who stutters needs language therapy.
Yeah.
You know, it just isn't the same thing. And so I really think that it is true what you're talking about, that we work with such a complex and rich disorder. At some level, that keeps some of us ever looking. You're definitely one of those people. I think I'm one of those people. But it's also, in a sense, very frustrating because it is a moving target. What we see one day may not be the important thing to be seeing the next day.
Well, thank you for your kind compliment about our work at Stutter Talk about a minute ago. That was really kind of you. And I think it's so cool that you do have this immense background and interest in language because, you know, in some ways, your views on treatment like Lidcombe, it might be much more important than the developer's views for certain things because you're looking at it perhaps in a different way.
I like to contextualize Lidcombe. I think an awful lot of the benefits of Lidcombe come from the parental involvement, which is something that you and I just finished talking about a little while ago, which is not as typical in other forms of intervention. And we did do a small study, which the developers are not so crazy about, in which we did sort of suspect that some children get more fluent by sort of aiming a little less high in their language use. Not that they're losing language, which was one interpretation, but that they just didn't talk as much and beyond their capacity to be fluent, and somehow the system sort of reached equilibrium. So I'm fascinated by Lidcombe because it basically doesn't, we've talked a lot about Lidcombe before, but there are lots of ways to explain why it works. Unfortunately, not the developers don't tend to be very interested in how it works, rather they're interested in whether it works. But some of us are more fascinated by other things. We're still looking into the issue of whether or not language is part of the constellation in stuttering and in young children, and we are going to be sending out for review an article that does suggest in a fairly large cohort that language profiles, both at onset and as children are followed over a 3-year period, do tend to predict whether or not they persist or recover. And they also distinguish children who stutter from children who don't stutter, who were matched to them in the study. So I think there's a lot that we need to learn about the role of language formulation in children stuttering. It may be what kicks the system into a destabilized state, and we see a little kid who's starting to stutter. What it takes to continue to stutter and to look like an adult who stutters are going to be a bunch of very different sets of factors, I think.
Wow, I could talk to you all day. We sure got some straight talk from you, which is so appreciated. I just love the straight talk. So we got to get you back on air when that study is published regarding language.
Absolutely.
Well, all right. Thank you, Nan Bernstein-Ratner from the University of Maryland College Park. Thanks for joining us in Stutter Talk.
Thanks an awful lot, Peter.
I just remembered what I was going to tell you. You were talking way back when in the show about how the spontaneous recovery and not doing anything. And I just, my son's kindergarten class, a mother came up to me and she's like, I don't know if you remember me, but our kids were in gymnastics when they were 3. And I didn't remember her until she reminded me about all this. And she was really upset and I didn't know her. And I said, are you okay? And she's like, my daughter just started stuttering this week. And so at gymnastics class, we're talking all about it. And I saw her the next week and we talked all about it again. And that happened for a few weeks. And then I saw her after 2 years and she said to me, my daughter stopped stuttering like after 6 months of stuttering. And then she started telling me about all the things she did. And like she was like reading, like she had she knew all the like best tips from the Stuttering Foundation website. And she talked about implementing all this stuff. And she was saying how she decided not to do treatment. And I said to her, "You did do treatment." And
she, right. And she that was treatment, yeah.